Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
This is a routine thing for us. We go every year. We keep all of our statistics and our records from what we see. And this year, it was no shock to see what we had been hearing, which was we had a dry season last year in Kansas, for example, and that kind of area of drought has expanded over last winter and into this year. And the wheat crop is continuing to struggle in a lot of areas just because of dryness.
So what were they finding in the Plains winter wheat fields? Dave Green is with the Wheat Quality Council.
And our tour kind of confirmed that more than found it. It was pretty well known. There was a lot of dryness around, and our tour kind of put a stamp on it and kind of got a lot of publicity because this was probably the worst conditions we had seen in our lifetime.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I'm not being a jerk here. It's not that I feel I can prove that there was no discussion about it.
Arizona Republican Representative David Schweikert, a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, on the debt ceiling bill.
There's this absolutely duplicitous thing going on here in Washington. Can you imagine that? Where I will have conversations with some of my Democrat colleagues when there's no camera around or reporter around, and they understand that they know it's immoral not being willing to talk about Social Security. And in less than, 9 years, the trust fund is gone. Our brothers and sisters who are 65 and up take a 25% cut in their check. And therefore, the United States will double senior poverty. That's immoral. And yet we had a president get up behind that podium during his State of the Union say, you're not allowed to talk about and we're not going to touch Social Security. Okay. And we all applaud it. But the cruelty of that is great politics. And in 9 years, we double senior poverty because of our unwillingness to tell the truth about the math. That's not feelings. It's math. And it also has this little ethical overtone. It's immoral what we're doing, but it's good politics.
And at the end of the day, Schweikert says it's politics that punish policy.
There's this intense sense of frustration because we passed actually a fairly substantial immigration bill, border security bill, and it will go nowhere in the Senate because of politics. When our Democrat colleagues are willing to admit that the last couple of years have been crushing to the working poor in America, it's a fascinating and someone should actually do their PhD paper on this. 15 years ago, it was the left that advocated for border policies to not import huge waves of poverty because that crushed working people in America. And they used to accuse Republicans of wanting an open border for cheap labor. Something happened politically, particularly over the last decade, where that flipped. And there's some really interesting academic papers out there talk about one of the cruelest things you can do to the working poor in your country is import large numbers of other people who are with moderate skill sets. If you need to grow the economy, which we desperately do, you see our labor constraints we have. U.S. fertility rates are now hovering at, 1.7? So in 18 years, the United States has more deaths than births. We actually have a fertility crisis and demographic issues. You would actually engage in what much of the rest of the industrialized world is doing, which is trying to steal each other's smart people. You know, whether that be a skilled carpenter or, you know, a physicist. And that requires sort of an adult conversation of what's actually happening in the country demographically, labor supply. But the only way you're going to get to doing a pro-growth, pro-stability immigration piece of legislation is you got to lock down the chaos that is the border. And if you want to see the second degree, third degree effects of open border policies, come to my community, come to Phoenix, Arizona, where I can show you zip codes where the homelessness has doubled. Fentanyl is crashed in price and is everywhere. And parts of these are derivatives, whether you like it or not, of the current Democrats' border policy.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, as we look at ways to reduce feed cost and with the decrease in the price of milk on farm, one of the things we're going to have to be concerned about is margin in the next several months.
Dr. Mike Brook is Kansas State Dairy Specialist.
There are some things you can do to actually reduce your feed costs that will help your overall margin. When it comes to forages, you've got forages stored, and I'm thinking mostly of your silages. So whether it be corn silage or alfalfa haylage or maybe some sort of small grain haylage, it's a wet feed and can spoil very quickly in the summer heat. So correct face management is really important. Keeping that face small and making sure that we use enough off that face every day to keep that fresh. So during the summertime, it would be best if we could use about 12 inches off the face every day. I know some of you probably have silos that are large enough that that's not possible. So maybe you only feed down half and then go back and get the other half of the face to try to move back in the silo a little further each day. Excellent face management during the summer is also very important, making sure that we only knock down as much feed as what we're going to actually feed in that day, so that at the end of the day, we actually have a nice, clean, straight face, and that way we'll see less heating overnight before the next feeding day. Cleaning bunks on a regular basis is going to be an important part of your feeding strategy as well. Making sure that we only feed what we need to each day so we don't carry over feed to the next day. Secondary fermentation in that bunk can account for a lot of waste if you're feeding too much feed. So you're going to have to make some decisions. I know a lot of times in the dairy industry with our lactating dairy cows, we want to try to feed a little extra each day so they always have feed in front of them. And during the summertime, we just probably need to keep that to a minimum because likely that feed's going to spoil overnight, and we're going to have to throw it away the next day. So trying to reduce the amount that we throw away every day is very, very important. We want to feed the cows adequately. That's the challenge. So if we're feeding later in the day, our last load of feed, we've got a chance to maybe adjust the bunk a little bit so that we can reduce the amount that we might have to throw away the next day. Finally, one thing to think about is we begin harvest of small grains as well as alfalfa. For putting that up as silage, making sure that we do a good job of packing our silage to exclude the air from that so that we get a reduction in the amount of heating that occurs. Harvest moisture is very, very important. Again, we want to stay between that 35 and 40% dry matter as we harvest these forages, but we still have to do an adequate job of packing. Don't forget about the inoculants. Those are very important. Again, lactic acid bacteria inoculants are probably the thing to consider for alfalfas as well as small grain silages, making sure that we get that applied correctly. And the best place to do that would be your forage chopper. And then make sure you get it covered quickly.
Dr. Mike Brook, Kansas State Dairy Specialist. Speaking of dairy, USDA out with their latest World Ag Supply Demand Estimate Report, or WASDE, milk production for this year forecast lower than last month on slower growth in milk per cow than previously expected. Milk production for 2024 unchanged from last month. Commercial exports also lowered on both fat and skim solids bases. All milk price forecast $19.95 per hundredweight. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, I know if I'm glad to say or sad to say, it's going on about 20 years now, and I've seen a lot of change, certainly a lot of growth.
Dave Salmonson is a trade expert with the American Farm Bureau Federation on how the landscape has changed over time.
I can remember about when I was started, moved over from other issues to doing this. U.S. Ag exports annually were right about $40 billion, a little more, and now we're approaching $200 billion a year. So, as I like to tell folks, the world wants what the U.S. makes when it comes to ag products.
Of course, one of the highlights of the past 20 years has been China.
Well, if you go back a few years, as we all remember, we've had steady growth, and we had the tariff issues, the so-called trade war back there in 2018, 2019, where our exports dropped quite a bit for a couple years. And then we had the phase one agreement with China, U.S.-China agreement. Exports rebounded. China had those purchase commitments, and they've continued to go up. So we're right now, last year, I think we were about $36 billion in ag sales to China, the most ever. And this year, I think the expectation is that we'll reach that level or maybe more. We'll see how the year develops. China still continues to be a huge importer of U.S. soybeans. I think, you know, it's just a... probably about, you know, half of all of U.S. soybeans are exported, and more than half of what we export goes to China. So, big impact on the U.S. And they're, you know, buying so many of other products, of course. They, you know, they're in the corn market. They're buying beef. They buy pork. They buy all kinds of things from the U.S. So, but China overall imports annually over $200 billion a year in ag and food products. So, a strong market. Of course, there's concerns. We all read the news and know of all the factors that are going on in the U.S.-China relationship. Not a smooth one anymore, if it ever was smooth. And that certainly is something that might have an impact going forward. But we know that it's important that that market is to U.S. farmers and ranchers, and we want to see it continue, and if we can, see it grow. So U.S.-China is always something that we keep a have to keep a strong eye on, and let our people know that it is important to American agriculture, as is all their markets in the region. But, you know, recognizing that, we're also watching closely how these discussions in the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, the Biden administration's initiative there, they're going with a lot of the other countries in the region, and is not included in this. And can we get lowered some trade barriers in several of those countries? You know, there's sanitary and phytosanitary barriers. There's licensing barriers, because we want to grow our exports to other markets, especially in Southeast Asia, which has such a strong economy, rising incomes among the population there. We know we can sell more into that region. So, again, we're all have to keep a strong push to expand market opportunities.
Rich Nelson is a chief strategist with Allendale.
Main discussion point, though, for this very big player on the cotton world is they still do have a slightly tighter supply situation than last year in terms of a stock discussion. So as far as the China news, not a major change in the general story from last month here.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You know, for the most part, these numbers from USDA's perspective were moderately changed. And we do have to consider that USDA does have a method, so to speak, especially with corn and soybean numbers. We can say that the wheat the balance sheet is more or less live and more realistic. But for the most part, USDA did not offer a lot of surprises. A moderate change for old crop discussions and still on new crop questions. A lot of those we pushed off for future months here.
Rich Nelson is the chief strategist for Allendale, looking at the latest WASDE report from USDA.
You know, for the wheat discussion, USDA has some questions for us, especially at this time of year. Keep in mind the old crop marketing year ended on May 31st for old crop wheat. USDA left their estimates for stocks for old crop unchanged on this report. Keep in mind they will be adjusted at the end of this month, when they have a quarterly grain stocks report. So that will put the final stamp on the old crop picture for wheat specifically. New crop discussion, they made minor changes here today. They raised their prior estimate of all wheat production by 6 million bushels. They gave a little bit more of it to hard red, 14, and took a little bit off for soft red and white. So main message for the wheat side, relatively consistent U.S. balance sheet, no major changes. They did add a bit for production for our competitors, though, both Russia, India, as well as Ukraine on this report here.
So moving from wheat over to corn, and Nelson explains.
I know USDA chose to make some minor changes for the corn balance sheet, but not really changed the story yet. Old crop stocks, they were raised by about 35 million bushels on this report, reflecting some problems with export sales, which are quite well known. And there will be future declines for export sales in future reports as well. So they don't have the job completely done there. New crops side, they did not adjust any of the acreage numbers, and they also did not adjust yields on this specific report. You know, they haven't touched yields too much in June anyway, only five times over the past 25 years. So that will be reserved probably for the July or more likely the August report ahead. So as far as new crop stocks, still implying a large supply waiting for us, over 2.2 billion bushels. The question now is trying to prove risk, weather risk, and trying to peel back some of those bushels so we can have some higher prices in the short term.
Some questions early on before planting season as to whether to go with corn or soybeans.
And that soybean story is different than corn. You know, keep in mind, we all understand there's a large ending stock discussion. No problem with that argument, just like there is with corn. But soybeans did something different in the recent weeks. That pushed down on November soybeans to $11.30 and a half cents. That literally priced in trend yield for soybeans. So different than corn, we fully priced in trend yield and big supplies. So the positive thing is, even though USDA still didn't touch the balance sheet too much here today, they added 15 million to the old crop stock number. They didn't really touch yields or acres on today's new crop numbers either. The positive thing is, any yield declines off of trend, which most of us can agree on, there's some type of movement there, that goes directly on top of price. So soybeans, different than corn, do have the ability to freely move up as we have concerns recognized on this weather situation.
That's Rich Nelson, Chief Strategist with Allendale. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
My name is Brian Sievers. My wife Lisa and I operate a diversified grain and livestock farm in eastern Iowa.
Sievers testifying recently before the Senate Budget Committee.
We own and operate a 2,400-head beef cattle feedlot and raise corn, soybeans, hay, winter wheat, cover crops, and native prairie grasses on approximately 2,000 acres. Along with our partner Raceland Alternative Energy, we also own and operate an on-farm anaerobic digester, which processes the livestock manure from our cover crops to produce renewable energy and sustainable, natural, renewable fertilizers for our farmland. The relationships we've established with Raceland Alternative Energy and its founder, Rudy Raceland, along with organizations such as the American Biogas Council, Solutions from the Land, the Iowa Smart Agriculture Group, Iowa State University's and Penn State University's Grass to Gas Grant Program, and a large number of conservation and wildlife organizations, veterans groups, and commodity trade organizations will help grow the opportunities to enhance stewardship in our farming and livestock operations in the very near future. This coalition has increased significantly as scientific study of anaerobic digestion has demonstrated the benefits from biomass harvest and processing of winter hardy cover crops such as cereal rye, along with the biomass feedstocks from our new or previously established native prairie, along with the more traditional feedstocks such as swine, dairy, and beef cattle manure and food waste. These recent advances in science, research, and technologies, coupled with the new federal incentives, will allow the anaerobic digestion industry to grow significantly in the near future. The growth will allow the agricultural sector to provide significant yet practical solutions to enhancing soil health, water and air quality, food security, energy security, environmental and ecological services, wildlife habitat restoration, and carbon sequestration efforts. If I told you there was a way to increase farm sustainability and urban recycling, reduce municipal costs, and produce renewable energy in many different forms, plus fossil fuel-free fertilizers, would you say it's worth supporting? All of this and more is what anaerobic digestion technology offers, and we need to do more to embrace it, putting it on par with other renewables from a policy standpoint, but also recognizing that these anaerobic digestion systems offer communities so much more than just renewable energy. Digesters are unique in being able to produce an all-of-the-above set of solutions with respect to energy production, while also returning all of its organic inputs back to the soil to improve soil health, including soil carbon, organic matter, fertility, microbial activity, ecological services, and wildlife habitat. Anaerobic digestion is unique with this ability to provide multiple benefits, including economic security, energy security, food security, and fertilizer security while also addressing our changing climatic conditions. While enhancing the health of our soils, our water, and our natural resources, a growing biogas and anaerobic digestion industry can also provide vibrant, exciting new ways for rural economic growth, development, and job creation using recent advances in the technology of anaerobic digestion of organic feedstocks. There are a few policies that can help ensure Americans can benefit from these wide-ranging solutions, which stem from a circular approach to agriculture production. While approximately 500 farm-based anaerobic digesters have been built in the U.S. so far, we see the opportunity for at least 8,000 more systems to be built. The energy and conservation titles of the 2023 Farm Bill, including the REAP program and its underutilized technologies reserve, are key to this deployment and need full funding. Cuts to the grants or loans portion of the REAP program will reduce in rural investment, jobs, and sustainability. Farmers and small businesses around the United States believe the REAP program is a model for public-private partnering, which promotes rural economic development and environmental stewardship with common sense flexibility.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Q-tips are more than just what you stick in your ear. It actually is a pretty advanced estate planning concept, and it gets kind of detailed, but in farm and ranch estates, they're complex by nature because we're dealing with a business in many situations. And Q-tip Trust is just one avenue that allows a larger estate to still take advantage of what we call the unlimited marital deduction and leave the property to the surviving spouse in a form other than outright, which is normally the rule for receiving an unlimited marital deduction.
Roger McCowan is a tax law specialist at Washburn University.
A lot of the times that what we want to do is we want to provide something for the surviving spouse for life, and then often it's a remainder down to the children, particularly, you know, maybe one child of several is going to take over the farming operation. And so we want to kind of split the estate up, let the spouse benefit from the property, live in the farmhouse, get the rent from the property while the spouse is living. And then after the surviving spouse dies, then the full ownership and use and possession of the property comes into the hands of the children. The problem we have under the federal estate tax rules is that we can't get an unlimited marital deduction on property that passes otherwise than outright to the surviving spouse. And that marital deduction, as I indicated, is unlimited. We could have somebody such as a Bill Gates or a Warren Buffett with billions of dollars leave everything to the, well, in Buffett's situation, leave everything to the surviving spouse, and there is no estate tax. It doesn't matter how much is left outright to the spouse. It's tax-free. And you can do that during life. It's an unlimited gift tax amount, and you can do it at death. You can leave as much to your spouse as you want. There's no tax on it, whatever the amount. But the problem is that may not be the best plan because then you're loading up the surviving spouse's estate with a lot of wealth, and there could be potentially a tremendous amount of tax in the second estate. So a typical plan has been that we kind of balance the estates during life, get an equal amount of value in each spouse's name, and each leaves the other a life estate in a portion of the package that will optimize tax in the first estate and utilize marital deduction on the other package. Well, a concept came up back in the 1970s, and I think it was probably because there were people in the Congress that were serial marriers, you know, one spouse after another spouse after another spouse, and they would want to benefit the spouse to whom they're married to at the time they die, but yet leave property to the children of a prior marriage, which if you think of a farming operation and we have divorce and remarriage, that farm is probably going to want to be kept in the line of the children that were the result of the first marriage. That's often what we see. Well, if we've got a sizable estate and now we've got a federal estate tax issue, and this will become a bigger issue as we get closer to 2026 because that exemption is scheduled to drop under current law. If Congress does nothing, that exemption goes to $5 million inflation-adjusted dollars, so probably about $7 to $7.5 million. With the inflation adjustments, it will be in 25, probably about $15 million. So it's effectively going to get cut in half if Congress does nothing. So this concept becomes a bigger deal in these situations where we've got mixed families and multiple marriages. I don't want to necessarily leave everything outright to the spouse, but I've got children of this first marriage, and those are my farming heirs. So the Q-tip concept was developed probably because people in Congress had the same problem as an exception to the rule that you have to leave property outright to the spouse. So we can leave some of that in life estate form, but it has to be in a qualified form, qualified as a Q-tip, and then remainder down to the kids.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Yes, nationally, it appears condition ratings for the nation's pastures and rangelands are improving.
And that's more reflective of some of the rain that we saw back in May, especially across the nation's midsection.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says, as of this past Sunday,
45% of the nation's rangeland and pastures rated good to excellent, up 2 points from the previous week. And just 20%, very poor to poor, that's down 2 points from last week's 22%.
So an overall improvement, but not everywhere.
The short-term dryness is really taking a toll on grass growth in states like Missouri and Michigan. 47% very poor to poor in Missouri. Michigan coming in at 39% very poor to poor.
Pennsylvania, 46% of pastures are in the poor to very poor category there. Without rain, Rippey says expect next week's report to show worsening pasture and rangeland conditions. Gary Crawford, Washington.